Hi, this is Donald Davidson, host of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Thank you for joining us for the 30 days of May right here on Indy500Coverage.com, brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Value on display every day.
Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson on 1070 The Fan. I'm Kevin Lee at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, where the checkered flag has just flown, completing the day's activities here today, and it was a busy day. 35 cars on track today, and for the first time so far this week, weather was not a factor. It was cloudy and overcast throughout the day, but the rain has stayed away, and we saw similar speeds to what we've seen so far. Scott Dixon, 226.971 miles an hour. That's just a touch slower than the best speed we've seen put up Sunday by Elio Castroneves, just over 227. Ryan Briscoe, P2, then Alex Tagliani, Hideki Muto, Dario Franchitti, rounding out the top five. Will Power, Tony Kanaan, Elio Castroneves, Townsend Bell, and Mario Marias, rounding out the top ten. The only driver we did not see on track today that's been out so far is EJ Viso, but he has been cleared to drive, and they are working on the backup car. Did not get out today. Hopefully we'll see Viso at some point tomorrow. Jump on board. Telephone calls for Donald. 239-1070. The Talk of Gasoline Alley is next on 1070 The Fan. Thanks for joining us today at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Action is complete today. There was a lot of it. We'll talk about the history of the Indianapolis 500 and nostalgia for the next hour. Your questions for Donald Davidson at 239-1070. Then after 7 o'clock, it's trackside. Kurt Cavan of the Indianapolis Star will join me. My name, by the way, is Kevin Lee. Among our guests tonight, Bobby Unser will be here with us in a little while this evening. Also, we will talk with Thomas Schechter, and 15-year-old Andretti Autosport driver Zach Veach will be on the show with us tonight after 7. And then Parnelli Jones on tonight after 8 o'clock, one-on-one with Mark Monteith. 239-1070 is the number. Donald, good evening.
Hi, Kevin.
Let's get to the phone call. Start with Steve in Indianapolis. Steve, you're up with Donald.
Hi, Donald.
Hi, Steve.
Could you talk a little bit about the Sumar racing team?
Sure. Yeah, they were from Terre Haute, and they ran from 1953 to 1960. And Sumar was a name that was made up of the first letters of two ladies, and it was Don Smith's wife and Chapman's Root's wife. And Chapman Root was the grandson of the man who designed the Coke bottle that we know so well, and Susan Root and Mary Smith, and they took the S-U-M-A-R to get Sumar. And they had a speed equipment business for a while, and I really don't know very much about that. But as far as the cars at the Speedway, most of the drivers that they had, not only were they American, they were from Indiana. The original driver was Gene Force, who was second in the USAC, not in the USAC, but in the AAA Midwest Sprint Car Championship the year before. And he actually took the car out and practiced with it, and then was injured at either Fort Wayne or Dayton very early in May. But he had actually already been out on the track with the car. Jimmy Jackson got into it briefly, veteran Jimmy Jackson, who was basically retired by that point, but he did drive it in practice. And then it ended up being Jimmy Daywalt from Wabash, Indiana, who qualified. I think he started 24th, but he finished 6th and won the 1953 Rookie of the Year. That was the second year for the Stock and Wetzel Rookie of the Year award. Then in 54, they had three cars at the track, and they bought a new Curtis Craft that Jimmy Daywalt qualified for the middle of the front row. And then Jerry Hoyt was in the second car, and it ended up that he made at least one, maybe two incomplete attempts, but at least one, didn't make the race, and then he ended up driving for Bellinger. So Jimmy Daywalt had the only Sumar car in the race, and he led, I think, 8 laps at one point, not early on, but on in to the thing. And then just past the half distance, he tangled with Pat Flaherty, who was in as a relief driver for Jim Rathman, and so that took both cars out. Then in 55, influenced by the 1954 W196 Mercedes-Benz Streamline car, they decided to do a car with a fully enclosed streamlined body with the wheels enclosed and even a canopy over the cockpit. Well, very quickly they did away with the cockpit because they had a problem where not only the heat from the engine had nowhere to go, but also the friction would cause rubber and rubber particles to stick to the Perspex hood. And then also the question was, well, what do you do when he's ready to qualify? He can't raise his hand. Well, by the time it came time to qualify, that was off, and so was most of the body work. And the theory was that, so they just ran, basically, it was almost like the tub with the wheels sticking out, and it wasn't a very pretty sight when they qualified, but they ended up painting the thing, because it was just the exposed metal was the greater part of the body. But the thinking was that Jimmy Daboll was, I don't know that unnerved would be the term, but he liked to be able to see the left front wheel go onto the line at the apex of the turns, and with the enclosed body, it was a little hard to gauge the distance. Well, anyway, in its stripped-down form, he finished ninth. This is Jimmy Daboll. Johnny Boyd drove the second car, and this was the first non-Indiana driver to be in the cockpit, and he was involved in the accident which took the life of Bill Vukovich. And rather than go into that, we'll come back in 56 with Jimmy Daboll again back into his 1954 car, which was the one Boyd was in the Vukovich accident in 55. And then the Streamliner was back for another shot with Marshall Teague, the former NASCAR driver who had switched to AAA and had been the stock car champion now twice. And the Daboll car qualified. He did hit the wall in the race and did get a shot to the head, so was in the hospital for a short time, but was back running before long, and the Streamliner didn't make it. Then in 1957, they had three cars in the lineup, and it was the drivers were Pat O'Connor, Marshall Teague, and Dick Rathman. All three qualified. O'Connor was on the pole. He was the only one of the three from Indiana. And then Dick Rathman, and the cars were typically blue with white stripes, but the Rathman car was painted red. Well, after Rathman had qualified, let's just say that he was not able to drive on race day because of an eye injury, and there's different versions about how he got that, and the official and the non-official, but I'm not going to speculate on the air. Just say that he was not able to drive on race day, and so Johnny Parsons, the 50 winner, who had been bumped, ended up driving in the race. And O'Connor, all three were running at the end. Marshall Teague got seventh. O'Connor, the pole car and early leader, was delayed slightly and did finish eighth. And then Johnny Parsons, with the car that Dick Rathman had qualified, finished in 16th. And in 58, Pat O'Connor qualified middle of the second row. And Marshall Teague in the second car was not able to get in. Also, Ray Crawford drove it briefly in practice on the last qualifying day, but just the O'Connor car was the only one that made it. And then tragedy, turn three, lap one, huge accident, and Pat O'Connor lost his life. I don't know if they gave any thought to no longer running. By the way, they did run other races. They had a couple of dirt cars by this time, and Len Sutton drove for them. Jerry Unser drove for them at Len Sutton with some success. I think he had like two or three fourth place finishes towards the end of the 58 season. The 59 driver was Bobby Grimm, who was the four-time IMCA champion. Sprint cars almost exclusively on dirt. They ran Salem and not very many paved tracks. And then Bobby Grimm jumped from basically half-mile dirt tracks to a 2.5-mile paved oval. He did qualify in the middle of the second row. We're almost done. Bobby Grimm, being a Hoosier driver, born in Coal City, but lived much of his adult life in Indianapolis. In fact, very, very close to the track. And he dropped out, finishing 26th, and it was rather an unusual situation in that he had a transmission failure, I believe, and he raised his arm to indicate that he was having troubles, just as he would have done in a sprint or a midget, to warn the drivers behind him, and the air caught it, and it pulled the arm out of the socket, which was very painful, and he obviously hadn't expected that, but he was running considerably faster than he normally would be. So when he came into the pits, they took him out of the car, not realizing that there had been a mechanical failure, and they put Jack Turner in it, but Turner never left the pits. Anyway, Bobby Grimm, although he was out of the race, he was back at the victory banquet with his arm in a sling, and he was declared the Rookie of the Year for 59, and we're almost done, the final run, and they'd reversed the colors, by the way. Now this car was white with blue stripes instead of blue with white stripes, and the same paint job for 1960 with Gene Hartley, yet another Hoosier from Roanoke, and he was still running at the end of the race in 14th, and that was the end of the Sumar team. There was a nostalgic throwback, if you like, and I can't believe this is 10 years ago. In the year 2000, Andy Hillenburg, who was born and raised on the south side of Indianapolis, had this dream to revive the Sumar specials. And ran it in the race. He dropped out and finished 28th, but there was a great deal of interest. And they tried to get the car. The paint job actually wasn't as close to a Sumar special as I think they were originally aiming for, but still the thought was there, and it was actually called the Sumar special.
Thanks for your call, Kevin. Steve.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Harold is up with us next. Hello, Harold.
Hello.
Hi, Harold.
Donald?
Yes, sir.
The year Graham Hill won the 500.
Yes.
Jackie Stewart was a rookie, I believe, that year.
Yes.
And Jackie, during the race, his car broke down, I think, came to rest along turn four going into the front straightaway.
That's correct, yes.
I recall, I was in junior high school at the time, I recall that, did he not get out and attempt to push that
yes.
car back to the pit?
He did, yes. He pushed for... A fair distance. I mean, he pushed it for a little bit, and then I'm not sure why he stopped, but I think because what he was used to doing in Europe, this was the thing. Cars that were running at the end of the race were ranked ahead of cars that were out, regardless of lap count. And so what drivers would do sometimes, typically at Monaco, but other tracks as well, if you were having a problem, and you knew that you'd either lost an engine or you thought you were about to or something like that would happen. It was very typical. You had to complete the last lap within a certain time period. It was normally like 10 minutes or 15 minutes or something like that. And so what you would do is pull up at the start finish line when the race was almost over, wait for the winner to cross the line, and then you would push your car over and you would be classed as a finisher. And so I think Jackie probably had that in mind, and I don't know if an official, you know, told him you don't need to do that. And so he then left it and walked, golly, I don't know, 300, 400, 500 yards to a great ovation. And I mean, he played to the stands, but he was a great showman. And years later, we asked him, we said, well, you know, we understand that he saw the oil pressure drop, and so he just turned off the engine. And we thought, well, why would you do that? The Americans would run it till it blew up. And he said, well, I'm a Scotsman, and I was I was trying to protect my car owner's financial interest. But anyway, he did get sixth place, and he was voted Rookie of the Year. I thought what you were going to ask was, how come Graham Hill won the race and Jackie got Rookie of the Year? Well, the reason was that it's not just on the highest finish. Otherwise, you wouldn't need a committee, and there is one. And so Jackie was voted on just availability to the press and the qualifying effort and the fact that he led, I think, from 150 to 191 or something like that. And so it looked like he had the race won. What would have been interesting is if he hadn't have just turned it off, how far could he have gone? Because there's been people in the past that thought they were out of oil, like Mario in 69, for instance. And I'm off the track a little bit, but this one doesn't come out very much. Mario won the race in 69. And when they tore the thing down to get it ready for a future race, they took the transmission apart, and these little brown flakes came floating out, and it was just not only completely out of oil, but it had, you know, just burned up what was left. So, you know, he possibly couldn't have gone another half a lap.
Wow.
Harold, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
239-1070 is our telephone number, and Connor, you are up next. Randy actually has moved ahead of Connor. Randy, your question must be better. Please go.
Hello, Randy.
Hi, Donald. How are you?
Fine.
First a comment and then a question. I'm sure you don't remember, and I wouldn't expect you to, but I wanted you to know that back in the early 70s, from 1970 to 74, I was a student working my way through Franklin College. Uh-huh. And worked at the local Franklin radio station and did track reports every month of May. And I wanted to let you know that each of those years when I was up there doing track reports, you were always very gracious to me. You were always very good to give me interviews and give me time. And when you're a, you know, 19 or 20-year-old kid talking with Donald Davidson, that's about as good as life gets back then.
Well, thank you very much. Were you on the timing and scoring level doing qualifying reports then?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, then probably your radio station was unintentionally picking up the voice of Lou Palmer because, or maybe we were still upstairs in those days, but we used to be out on what I called the veranda. What years did you say? 70 to 74?
Right, 70 to 74.
Oh, all right then. Yeah. So then they would have those reports then were still done right outside of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network booth. And then finally, I think it was either in 78 or 79, IBC was obliged to move down to the level with all the other radio stations. And Lou's voice was so powerful that apparently other radio stations were picking him up because of the acoustics in there. But anyway, no, you're very welcome. I was always happy to do all of those things. And you know, you often wonder, well, I wonder what happened to that student. And it's very nice of you to call in. Thank you. Did you have a question, by the way?
Yeah, and again, thank you for being so kind. My question is, and I've never heard you speak about this, being in the business that you're in and associated with the auto racing industry, has it ever concerned you, or how do you deal with the fact that if you make friends and have friends in this business, you know, there's such a likelihood that you may end up losing some, and how have you dealt with that?
That used to happen all the time. And I don't know, really, because, I mean, there was a lot of people that I liked, but maybe it was just a little presumptuous to say that I was really close to them, although I felt that I was. And of course, it was a huge shock. And I can't really answer that except that it happened quite often in the 60s. And, I mean, other people in the 40s and 50s, that's what you went through. And you raise an interesting point because there was, and rather than get into names, it was not too many years ago where there was a fatality at an IRL race on the morning of the race.
That would be the one that I could share a personal experience about,
well, okay.
Being at it. But, yeah,
we know
who you're talking about.
Well, it was Sunday morning, and I had actually come into the track to do a little work. I must have been writing a program story or something. And as soon as I came in the door, did you hear that so-and-so was killed at wherever it was this morning? And so one of my first thoughts, and maybe this might even be a little bit of facetious, but I thought, you know what? That is so unusual now.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how many people that there are down there that are either working for the IRL or involved with the team or doing PR or repping a driver. And not only is this the first one that they've experienced, it may not even have occurred to them that it could even happen. And it's you know, we don't really talk about it or like to talk about it. It's around every corner. So when I raised that question and somebody told me, they said, yes, you know, there was a lot of young people down there that they just come out of college and you know, they thought it was cool to be at the track and, you know, run around and you know, be rubbing shoulders with the drivers and booking them for, you know, to do your interviews or whatever it was down there in a variety of capacities. And it was just total shock because, you know, that guy that you know is now gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so fortunately, it's very rare these days, but it used to be very common. And how did I come to deal with it? I don't know. Probably from the time, I mean, when I first got interested in racing, in no time at all, within the first 2, 3, 4 months in the spring of 1957, there were several fatalities. And it just became that, you know, Grand Prix drivers, 2, 3, 4 a year, if not in Grand Prix, then in other forms of the sport. So you could take a Grand Prix lineup and look down, and if it was 15 starters or 17 starters, and you think, well, 3, 4, 5 of these people probably won't be living in a couple of years. And that was just the way it was.
I think your assessment of the feeling in the current, and that's a good thing, in the current generation of racing is accurate, that it does stun everybody. And obviously we were speaking of Paul Dana from a few years ago, and I was there that day at Homestead Miami Speedway, and I was also here at the track on the day that Scott Brayton died, and those are the only two that I've dealt with. And I was much more entrenched in the sport for Paul Dana and knew all of the other competitors. I didn't know Paul Dana well, had talked with him several times, but he was a rookie. He had been in lights before, didn't know him well. But I know many of the other drivers well, and I remember thinking, you think this for a brief moment. What are we doing? What are we doing? And then you get past that, and I reconciled it this way. Well, these drivers that I know and like understand what's involved.
Yes.
And if they're willing to deal with it, then okay. Yeah. Okay, it's their life. It's their choice. They and their family understand that this is involved. Luckily, it rarely happens again, and we rarely have to deal with it. But if they, as long as they understand it, then I'm okay being a part of it on an outside type of level. And that's how I dealt with it. And race car drivers, they don't think about it very long. They just get back out in the car, and they do what they do.
I remember Scott Brayton was I mean, that took some getting used to, because I think Vince Welsh and I had interviewed him, I think, like the day before. And
I had talked to him just two or three days before,
And the fact that he did that amazing, probably the biggest, you know, crapshoot, for want of a better term, that I've ever seen, was when qualifying was the old way. And he had qualified for the outside of the second row, which was fine. It was a wonderful starting position. But he'd won the pole the year before. And he went to John Menard and thought, you know, let's withdraw this car and go with a backup. And when I heard they were going to do that, I thought, you're kidding. People have done that. They've withdrawn a car when they were down near the end and thought, rather than go through the ordeal of being bumped, let's pull it and then go again. But to improve your time, nobody had ever done that before. And so they withdrew the car, and it was like 20 to 6, a quarter to 6 or something. And I thought, Scotty, you know, this ain't worth the gamble, I don't think. But he went out and he won the pole. Anyway, the thing is that he'd won the pole for the second year in a row. And he knew that nobody had done it three times in a row. And that was his ambition now, was the next year he wanted to come back and be the first person to win the pole. But anyway, what was fantastic was his great interest in history, his knowledge, which a lot of drivers in recent years have not had. Anyway, there were 8 previous back-to-back pole winners, and he could name them all. That was amazing. And then, you know, we were interviewing him, and in fact, I think we even had him do it on the old Channel 23 show that we would do every lunchtime with Vince. And then all of a sudden, he's gone.
Yeah.
And the car had to move to the back of the pack, and there's asterisks about winning the pole, but you didn't start on the pole. That was a shocker, because he'd been around for a long time. But I don't know, maybe I could just pull up something. And I don't know how I dealt with it, but I mean, Judd Larson, you know, I had heroes that I'd never met when I was, you know, 14, 15 years old, and they're going left, right, and center. Then after I got here, I mean, I met Eddie Sachs, and I didn't meet Dave McDonald. I mean, I stood right very close to him on one day, but I did meet Sachs and talk with him and had great conversations with him. And then, in no time, and then there was a guy named Don Horvath. There was another early one, but, Judd Larson, who I knew, got to know very well. And, Chuck Rohde and Jimmy Davies. And anyway, I don't want to get too morbid.
Sure. All right, Randy, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Donald.
Okay, thanks.
More of your questions for Donald. 239-1070 is the telephone number. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. It's time now to play tonight's Inspire Indy 500 Fun Fact Challenge. Answer the following fun fact correctly. You can win tickets to Community Day, be qualified for the race weekend grand prize, a two-night stay at the Omni Severin, breakfast for two and two tickets to the 500 Festival Parade and the Indianapolis 500 as well, courtesy of Indianapolis Downtown Inc. Downtown Indianapolis, amazingly always new. This week's, or tonight rather, is the fun fact challenge is, when did the last front engine roadster win the Indianapolis 500? Most of you are going to know that, but you'll need to get to Indy500coverage.com to play. If you're not sure of the answer or to do some other research, there's a handy research link there to Inspire, Indiana's virtual library, free to all Hoosiers, right on the contest page, Indy500coverage.com. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson. Gil in Indianapolis is up next.
Hello, Gil.
Hi, Donald. Hi, Kevin. I spoke with you last night, Kevin. That was an honor.
Oh, thank you.
I have a question about a gentleman. I enjoy IndyCar racing, NASCAR racing, dirt car racing, but I also go to hydroplane racing. In southern Indiana, there is a hydroplane race at Madison, Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Is this about Bill Cantrell?
It is about Bill Cantrell.
Okay.
I would like for you to give me any information you can about him.
Okay.
And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay. Bill Cantrell, and this is another thing that's a little confusing. There was also a Billy Cantrell on the West Coast, and the Bill Cantrell that you're asking about from Louisville was at the track from 1948 to 1952, and then in 53 there's a Billy Cantrell, and one would assume that it's the same guy, and it isn't. Anyway, the Bill Cantrell that you're asking about that ended up living in Madison was from Louisville, and he drove sprint cars. He drove with a group called Central States Racing Association, CSRA, but he also ran USAC. And at Indianapolis, his first start was in 1948, and he drove a car called the Fagerolles Twin Coach Special. And so some people might be thinking, oh, that's the car that Paul Russo drove with the midget engine in front, midget engine in the back in 46. No, this was a different car. This was actually the ex-Rex Mays Bo Seal Fast Special that's in the museum right now. And in the form that it was owned by Lou Fagerolles, who had a bus manufacturing company in Kent, Ohio. And they put a bus engine. It was a six-cylinder diesel truck engine, a bus engine, I should say. And anyway, he qualified the thing when you had quite a bit of diversity in the lineup. And he ran in the top 10. I think he was running like sixth and then dropped out fairly late and got 16th. And then in 1949, he was back with the same car, qualified, and it got bumped. And he got back in, a driver named Les Anderson from Portland, Oregon, who had the Kennedy Tank Special that had run in 47 and 48. And he wasn't really comfortable at the speeds they were running by now, and so he turned it over to Bill Cantrell, who qualified the car and then drove in his second 500 and dropped out of that one and finished 21st. I don't remember the lap counts, but he got 16th in 48, 21st in 49. Then in 50, he was on the Bo Seal Fast team, which had really come down a couple of pegs, and Troy Ruttman wrecked one and was able to get into the field with what they called the baby bows, and the big one that was the 1948 pole sitter was in the hands of Bill Cantrell and made an incomplete attempt, so he didn't make it that year. But he did get back in very briefly as a relief driver for Bayless Leverett, drove the Palmer Special, which was owned by Fred and Richard Palmer of Indianapolis, and Bill Cantrell got in, and I think he went two laps. So he did actually drive very briefly relief for a car that got 27th place. And then in 51, he was in a couple of different cars, including a GMC-powered car that was called the Motor Trend Special. They wanted to call it the Hot Rod Special, but AAA said no because people will think it's a hot rod, so it was the Motor Trend Special. And that one didn't go to the qualifying line, and then he had was in a couple of cars in 52 and didn't make it. Anyway, at the same time that he was running Indianapolis, he was also a very successful powerboat driver, and the Gold Cup at I think was held at Detroit, and I suppose he ran Seattle. I'm not sure about that, but certainly the Detroit River was the big one, and then Madison, he ran down there as well several times, and then ended up living there. And I believe that is there like a monument to him? I don't think it's a full statue, but I think there's a monument of some kind in Madison today. Evidently we must have lost him.
Yeah, but, Gil, are you still with us?
Gil?
No, Gil's
gone.
All right,
then. But I believe that there's some kind of a monument to him down there, but. I met him. He came to a race at Winchester one time, and that must have been sort of like mid-70s, so I did get to meet him once.
Okay. Thank you, Gil. Gordon in Lebanon is up next with Donald Davidson on 1070 The Fan.
Hello, Gordon.
Yes, I was calling. I've been in a safety patrol for 30 years.
Oh, I know who you are. Yes.
Yeah, I know who you are. Anyway, the reason I was calling, I know it was in the 90s. You remember this year, they're going to have three Penske cars, but remember one time, Allens or Junior, all them guys, couldn't make the race.
That's
and
95.
Penske was a spectator. Do you know what year was that?
1995.
95, what?
Yes.
Not too long ago.
It was 15 years, which isn't very long ago.
Yeah, and the one thing about this racetrack, you can get too hot or you can freeze to death. Down here in Indianapolis.
Well, we haven't got too hot yet, but it's been pretty cold out here some days.
One time I even had sunstroke.
Uh-huh.
And it's working. But I was just wondering, which year was it? I know it was Emerson and Al Unser, but I don't know what the third car driver was.
They only ran the two that year. They'd run three the year before. They ran Al Unser, Emerson Fittipaldi, and Paul Tracy with the Yomo pushrod engines.
Okay.
And they only ran that one year, so... they were back with the regular Elmore engine, and there was something about the chassis where these engines didn't have the power the ones the year before, and they had various handling problems, so they were scrambling around at the last minute, leased different types of cars from other people, and then it ended up on the last day that they missed it. And as it turns out, the way things were, I think they could have made it with one, and it's easy for me to be a spectator and make such judgment. But they waved Fittipaldi off a run late on Saturday that they could have let him go and he would have made it. But they thought, we better be safe. And then when they came back the next day, they let him take four laps at a speed that was slightly slower. And they could have yellow flagged that one and still come back and made a final attempt. But they had people down there trying to help them. But honestly... This was a new experience for the Penske team because they'd been coming to the track for years and years and years, and they were always on the pole or the front row or the front two or three rows, and trying to make it on the last day was something that was a circumstance that they had never ever experienced, and basically they ended up missing it. You know, some of the lesser teams that had been playing that game for a while probably would have got it right, but they ended up missing it. But there was all kinds of class. I remember people saying, oh, gee, you know, the tragedy, and they're going to start an extra row to let the Penske cars come in, or Penske's going to buy a couple of cars and withdraw them so his cars can come in as an alternate. And they just very quietly loaded up, took all the signs down, and the next day they were gone.
Thank you, Gordon.
Thank you, Gordon.
Okay, bye. Okay.
Thanks. Steve in Indianapolis is next on the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson on 1070 The Fan.
Good evening, Donald. This is Steve calling, and one of my 500 traditions is hoping to get through and ask you a question each year, so I'm happy to do that again.
Okay, well, thanks for trying each year.
I hope you're doing well, but I hope that it's kind of a two-parter here. I'd like you to talk about one of my all-time favorites, Jimmy Bryan.
Okay.
And then I'd also hope that you take a minute to enlighten a lot of the fans about how some of the drivers used to stay in Speedway with families and that sort of thing. And I'm just really, really amused by the thought of Elio Castroneves sitting out in someone's front yard in a driver's suit after the race. So I'll hang up and enjoy your comments.
Well, I'll tell you what, before you do that, I wish you'd been able to get in earlier when I would have more time to do this, because I love to tell these stories. I could do, 20 minutes on Jimmy Bryan easily, because there's several things that he did that just superhuman feats, like a race at Phoenix on the dirt in 1957, but I won't have time to tell that one. But let's just say that Jimmy Bryan was, he won the 558. He was runner-up in 54 with a dirt car and got so severely beaten up that he even had to miss the next race. He drove the car back to the garage area, got out, went in, and actually collapsed on the floor. Big he-man that just got, beaten to a pulp, and the shock, right rear shock had broken, and he bought this. Vukovich won with a roadster, and Bryan was second with a dirt car. And the story is that he was lying on the ground, and a nurse came in to give him some first aid, and he opened one eye. And she said, "How are you feeling?" And he said, "I'm feeling just fine, baby. How are you feeling?" And then he closed his eyes again. But he did live with a family on 16th Street, almost to Cunningham. It's just past Lyndhurst, and I'm rather than identify the address, because maybe the people there living there today wouldn't appreciate it, but I go by the house all the time. And he stayed there, I think, for 7 years, 52 or 53. It was seven summers. And it wasn't just the 500 for him, because he'd come back from Phoenix, Arizona, and race championship stocks and sprints at first, although he eventually, cut back on those, and occasional sports cars. And he would just stay the whole summer. And he lived in the spare room upstairs, but, he was just family, and he would take the kids to school, and this great story. One day he took the youngest son, who ended up being the Speedway fire chief years later, but hey, one day he drove the son to school in his stock car. But anyway, we probably need to take a break here, and I wish you'd call back again, and I'll do a much longer number on Jimmy Bryan and tell us some of the great anecdotes about a very wonderful man, superhero.
And safe to say, as Steve said, families did used to host drivers, and that's obviously...
We don't do that anymore. I'd love to talk about that.
I'm not really interested in staying in somebody's house I don't know either. So when I go into another city, I would prefer to stay in a hotel. So we can't just say that these highfalutin drivers wouldn't do that. I'm not going to do that. So thanks for the call, Steve. More of your questions for Donald at 239-1070 on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan with Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee. Dave in New Jersey is up next. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good evening, Donald. It's
Hello,
me again. Me again to bug you. I'm fine. I just got the Pat Kennedy book. It's great. I'm not as smart as I thought I was.
Oh, yeah. He did a great job. They're multiple choice, and I had this theory for quite some time that if you do a multiple choice quiz, you could make it harder or easier simply by the answers that you offer. And his is a challenge, because in a lot of the cases, his four answers, anyone, if it's something about who was the only driver to do so-and-so, he'll give you four names, and they're all decent possibilities if you don't know exactly what the answer is. It's hard to guess.
Mm-hmm. And some of them you second-guess yourself. Even when you go back, you say, boy, I knew that. Why did I? But in any case, I have three things, two real quick, and then a third one. On Ray Haroon, I had heard a story, I think from Chris Economaki, that in the late 60s, when his health was failing, that his wife used to drive him, or someone used to drive him into the infield.
Yes.
And he would just sit in the car and listen to the cars. Is that true?
He did. That's true. He'd come down on a qualifying day and sit in the infield.
What an opening for that movie, if they ever make it.
Oh, yeah, well.
Start with that and then fade to the 1911. The second was, with a quick Ray Haroon one, was... What was his nickname, and was that a misnomer, or was that true? It was a word I can't even pronounce. It meant something of Arabic descent.
Yeah, the Bedouin. The Bedouin. And I'm not sure where that came from, but he claimed that he was of Arabian descent and made up stories about it. And actually, he was Irish, is what I understand.
So it was something like a promoter would do, like they called Vukovich the Mad Russian and he was Ukrainian.
Oh, sure. Well, Leon Duray was the Flying Frenchman and he was actually George Stewart from Philadelphia. His nickname was, he was the Little Professor, and then he was also the Bedouin. And I never quite understood where the Bedouin came from. But, okay, I interrupted you. What was the last
one? No, that's fine. The last one, and then I'll shut up.
Okay.
Could you tell us about another character, if you have the time? I don't know how to pronounce his name. I'll give you the two of them. Okay. It's Larry Basaglia or Basaglia. But could you tell us about Larry?
It's Basaglia. Larry Basaglia. He pronounced it with a G. All right. He was... I think originally from Chicago, but in the later years he was from Reno, Nevada. And he came to the track for the first time in 1926. He did not come every year thereafter, but in 1948 he decided that he would come early and line up on 16th Street. And when he got here, there were two people in front of him. And so he thought, you know what? It would be neat because he'd read the paper sometimes because of all, the people would arrive several days before the race and just line up out on 16th Street, and they'd normally get their picture in the paper. And I think he probably thought, gee, that would be pretty neat. I'll do that. So next year he came back and intending to be the first in line and was surprised to find that there was one person ahead of him. So he thought, next year, by golly, I'm going to do it. So in 1950 he made it. And then for the next many, many years, I mean, his position got protected after a while. And he got a lot of publicity for the track. And it was sort of like a sign of spring that even in late April sometimes, but certainly very early May, there would be this little truck. It used to be, I think it was a Dodge that he had for a while. There was a pink Dodge. And then later on, Ford gave him a van in 1967, which was blue with some gold trim, and then that was his conveyance for many years, with decals all over the thing. Each year, he would update the year on the side, but I think he was claiming 2 years more than he really was entitled to, because what he did was he backdated it to 1948. And so, you know, when he would say this is the 37th year and, you know, first in line or whatever it was, actually, I think you have to deduct to go back to the newspapers and it will tell you where he was the second to arrive or third to arrive. But he was a great character. And just one quick story. He was coming back from Reno 1 year, and I think he was coming through Kansas. And he never drove, he drove under the speed limit. He was just rolling along very casually in the slow lane, and a cop pulled in behind him, followed him for a while, and then turned on the lights and pulled him over. And he thought, what can I? I haven't done anything wrong. And so the policeman came around and he said, what's wrong, officer? I don't think I was speeding. And he said, aren't you the guy that's first in line for the 500 every year? And he just wanted to talk to him.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave. Okay. And if you're on hold, you'll need to hang up and then call back, because Donald is shifting over to Network Indiana here coming up at 7 o'clock. A variety of stations around the state. You can find the list and links to some of these stations that have websites at Indy500Coverage.com. The number to call Donald, 1-800-603-6453. Here on 1070 The Fan, the racing conversation continues. Coming up, Kurt Cavan joins me for Trackside with Cavan and Kevin. Our guests tonight include Thomas Schechter and Bobby Unser. Stay tuned. That's coming up. Thanks to our studio producer, Matt Taylor. For Donald Davidson, I'm Kevin Lee from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan.
Everybody, welcome to another edition of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We will be here until 8 o'clock answering your questions of a nostalgic nature about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Anything that you would like to discuss about past 500s or the drivers who participated, we'll try and answer them for you. The number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. 603-6453, and we already have Eric from Vincennes is hanging on. Good evening, Eric. What would you like to hear about?
Good evening, Donald. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay.
I had a couple of questions for you. I wanted to ask you about I understand on poll day.
Yes.
You were talking over on the show that's on at 6. You were saying that you believe that up on the internet there was going to be some of Sid's old races. And I wanted to get that website from you and where we could hear those races and if at all those races would be available for purchase, because I'd love to purchase. What was his first year, 52 or 53 through 76?
All right, that wasn't me that said that. The first year was 1952, but it wasn't the race in its entirety. In 52, they did a beginning, an end, and updates throughout the day, but they didn't do a complete broadcast. 53 was the first year for that. Some years have been made available, and at one point there was a website you could go on, or there was a way that you could download certain broadcasts, and I think Scott Johnston is writing me a note here to tell me how to tell you to do that. One thing I can tell you is that on 1070 The Fan, on the night before the race, they're going to do Mike Sarawak is going to have an all-night party, but I don't think that starts until like 10 or 10:30. And two race broadcasts he's going to do is 1967 and 1992. But I think I'm going to have some info here in just a few moments about how you can. All right, here we go. I don't know if that one's. You could try this one. There was a website for a while that you could go on, and it was. I'll give it to you, but I don't know that you're going to get. You're going to get any joy. Try speedwayaudio.com. speedwayaudio.com, but I don't guarantee that there's going to be anything there. What you might do, and I don't remember what this number is, but you might call the Indianapolis Motor Speedway retail department, and that they might tell you that at one point there was a way, that I think in their catalog there was information, and somehow or other, and I don't understand modern technology at all, but there was a way that you could download certain broadcasts. And in fact, I think it went not too long ago, it was like every other year. I think you could get 62, 64, 66, 68, or something like that. So anyway, did you have a further question? All right. We just found out now that speedwayaudio.com does not work. So never mind. Just do that other one. I just call the Speedway. Just call the switchboard and ask for the retail department, and maybe they can tell you how to do it.
Yes, sir. I did have another question.
Okay, sure.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned, along with your partner there, that there was a website, though, on Saturday that was going to be available.
Oh, okay, he may have said that, and I wasn't paying attention. So if you listen tomorrow night, I'm sure he'll give the same information again. You mean Kevin Lee?
Yes, had mentioned that they were updating this one website and said that he believed that on poll day mm-hmm. that Sid's races were going to be up there.
All right, then.
And available to listen to then.
I did not hear him say that, and so I'll ask him about it, and I'm sure that he will mention it again tomorrow.
Okay, let me ask you one quickie.
Sure, yes, please.
Tell me about Jim Shelton and some of the gentlemen that worked with Sid up through 76, and I'll listen, and I thank you so much for your time.
Oh, well, okay. You're going to hang up and listen?
Yes, I sure will.
Oh, then I won't be able to ask you any questions back. But, I mean, you just mean some of the voices that were up through, through Sid's tenure.
Yeah.
All right. Jim Shelton was a WIBC person that was on air when radio was very different, and he did several, you know, gimmick shows, and he was basically an entertainer. He worked Turn 4. There was Mike Ahern, who was at another radio station in town and ended up becoming the anchor at Channel 8, the CBS TV affiliate for many, many years. Haven't seen him for quite a while, but he worked Turn 1 for several years. Howdy Bell, Doug Zink, Lou Palmer, Jerry Baker came on at some point, I think still during Sid's tenure. And then there was Jack Shapiro, who passed away in 1964. There was Bernie Herman was on the backstretch. And then... Briefly, I think in 1957, it was Jim... He became the voice of the Jim McIntyre. Jim McIntyre. He became the voice of the Cincinnati Reds. He was on once because what they, and I think it was 57. I hadn't really thought about this for a while, but I know that for the first few years, they didn't have a voice in each turn. They had a voice at the north end and the south end, and they would watch two turns. And then 1957 was the first year that they put one in each turn, and Jim McIntyre was one of those. And that's all the ones that I could think of for the moment that were on-air talent. As far as the driver experts were concerned, he had Maury Rose in 1955, and that was 1 year. I think 56, 57, 58, he didn't do one. And then after Fred Agabation retired, then Fred Agabation was the driver expert. And that went up through to 1966, I believe it was. There was a problem with Autolite began to buy time on the radio network. And because Freddie Agabation worked for Champion, they thought it was a conflict of interest, and so he stepped down for a few years, and Len Sutton did it. And I think Len did it from 66, I think, up until hazy on this. He did it for several years, and at some point he decided that he wasn't going to do it anymore. And I think maybe 75 might have been his last year, and then Agabation came back. I may have given Len a longer tenure than because I remember him being back here in 75. Maybe he was no longer on the network, but I think it seems to me that he did it like 6 or 7 years. But as far as other voices, I think I've covered all the ones that I can think about. But yes, are you still there? Nope. Okay, very good. And then as far as stories about them, probably the Lou Palmer story is that he worked turn three in 1958, and the old line was, we'll put him out there because nothing ever happens in turn three. And coming around on the very first lap, there was a huge accident, and rather than go into all the details of that, it was a multi-car accident, and Lou did this amazing call on it. It was actually his first lap of action. And then a similar thing happened to Bob Lamy, which is several years later, in 1988. This is, you know, long after Sid's tenure. Bob Lamy was on turn two, and again thinking, well, nothing ever happens over there. And Howdy Bell had that spot for several years, and there was an accident where Scott Brayton, the car got away from him coming across the short chute and going into turn two, and he collected Roberto Guerrero and then also Tony Bettenhausen. Junior hit the wall a little bit further back, so that was Bob Lamy's baptism by fire. Anyway, if I think of it a little bit here, maybe we'll take a break here, and I might think of some other anecdotes about and maybe some of the names that should have come to the fore and didn't, and we'll address that in just a few moments. So anyway, Dave from Marion, you hang on because we'll be getting to you next. We'll be here for about another 45 minutes answering your questions about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, its history. The number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. You are listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We are back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana, and we're going to go to Dave from Marion. And Dave, good evening.
Hello, Donald.
Hi, Dave. And before I give you a chance to answer the question, during the break, Scott Johnson and I were brainstorming on voices that were on the network that I had neglected to mention. I was just spacing. I thought I had just about all of them, and now I think I've got at least seven more between the two of us. Did Charlie Brockman, and I'll give Scott Johnson that one. Charlie Brockman was in the booth for two or three years, I thought, or maybe more than that, probably 4 or 5 years, I think. And then there was Bill Frosch, who was WISH radio. Easy Gwynn from WIBC was on once and maybe a couple of times. But regulars, Chuck Marlowe, I neglected to mention, he was on for many years. And within Sid's tenure, Ron Carroll, I neglected to mention him, and that was Scott Johnson's. And then also Greg Smith, and then Luke Walton. I forgot all about Luke Walton, who did that for years, working the pits, and then also doing the introduction of Tony Holman just right before Gentlemen Start Your Engines. So there still could be others, and as they pop into my mind, we'll bring them to you. But anyway, Dave, thanks for hanging on. What would you like to hear about?
Oh, dear, there's so many.
Okay.
How about some Manny Aiello?
Oh, okay, very good. I'd love to do it. Manny Aiello, his real name was Manuel Leonardis, or something like that, Aiello. And he was Peruvian, or at least his father was Peruvian. And it took me a little while to get to the bottom of this, because I wondered if he was Peruvian-born. He was actually born in Los Angeles. His father was a Peruvian diplomat, and I've read some reports where his parents were Peruvian diplomats. Well, actually, his mother was American. She was from not very far from Darlington. In fact, when they ran down at Darlington, South Carolina, and he won the 54 version, there were several relatives that came to apparently visit him at the track because they lived fairly close. But anyway, the father was stationed in L.A., and where the speed bug came from, I don't know, but very early on, Aiello and Jack McGrath became very good friends, and that continued for the rest of their lives, which ironically both ended in 1955 at different tracks. But Aiello's first year at the Speedway was 1948. It didn't take him long to get there because I don't think he started racing until 46. But with the down for 4 years during the war and then coming back, there were a number of drivers that had run before the war that were still going. But there was also opportunities for the young upstarts, and there was this influx of track roadster drivers that we mentioned. I'd rather go through the whole bunch again. McGrath and Aiello came back together. And Manny drove for, or did not qualify. He was in a car that was owned by Conrad Wydell, who was a track roadster driver and owner. And the car was called the Bob Estes Lincoln Mercury Special. And he made three incomplete attempts. Normally, you take the checker on the final, but for some reason, he must have had problems or whatever. But anyway, he did go out three times and didn't complete either of the runs. And then at the last minute, he jumped into one of the Granatelli cars. And actually, the gun went off, but they pushed him off anyway. And then, of course, he got flagged in at the end of the first lap because the track had already closed. Anyway, 49, he drove a car for Carl Hall, qualified after the field was full, and was too slow to bump in, and then at the very last moment got into a car. There was another West Coast driver named Bill Scheffler, Bayard T-Bone Scheffler, who was had been a student at UCLA, pole vaulter or high jumper or both, I forget which now, but anyway, he had two cars. And he'd qualified one, and Tommy Mattson, a sprint car driver, had been trying to qualify the other, had two strikes on it, and they put Aiello in, and he did manage to qualify, and but just barely. So he made it in, but he was the 33rd fastest qualifier. I believe he started 33rd. Anyway, he dropped out early. In 50, he didn't make it, and then 51, he qualified and got bumped. Another car name that I used to love, the Coast Green Special, owned by Bob and Denny Weinberg. But Aiello got to drive virtually half the race because McGrath suffered from leg cramps and he needed relief. And at exactly the halfway point, he got out, Ayulo got in and drove the Hinkle Special, Jack Beckley, and drove it for the entire second half and finished third behind Lee Wallard and Mike Nazaruk. In 52, he qualified the Coast Grain Special and finished 20th. Then 53, he was one of the first. He might even have been the first person to qualify. He started fourth, but I think he was the first to do the four-lap run. I'm not positive about that, but everybody was kidding because normally he would be the last person on the last day to make a shot. He was sort of like the George Snyder of the day. They came down for the start, and Vukovic took off from the pole, and Ayulo tucked in behind him and was second going into the first turn. Tony Bettenhausen was in the mix, and I think Ayulo had several different times when he was running second. He stayed within top 10 until fairly late in the race and dropped out. He ended up 13th, but I think he was running like 5th or 6th with not very many laps to go. And then in 54 with a new Curtis Roadster, again he was 13th. And that was the last time that he would drive in the race because in 55 he lost his life hitting the first turn wall on a qualifying day, but not in a qualifying run. Just before the track closed, he hit the first turn wall in a practice run and did not survive the accident. In terms of championship racing, I suppose midgets, he drove midgets and he drove sprints, but he really got going in championship in 1953. He did not win a race, but he was second four times and ended up fourth in the championship. I think he was second four times. Anyway, he was the fourth ranking driver of 53, and then in 54, although he was running car number 88 in 1955, he was the second ranking driver. He won the Milwaukee 200. He also won the Darlington 200 and was second in points behind Jimmy Bryan. Anyway, Dave, thank you very much indeed. I love to talk about Manny Ayulo. In fact, he lived when he was in Speedway, living very close to the track. But we are going to have to take a break, so everybody else hang on. We'll be back with you shortly. So Donald from Virginia, Jay from St. Paul, hang in there. The number to call to get on this program with your question is 1-800-603-6453. That's 1-800-603-6453. We'll be here till 8 o'clock, but we do have to take a break right now. We'll be back with more after this, the talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. Back with the second half of the talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We will be here tomorrow and Friday night from 7 until 8. And then not over the weekend, but next week, Monday through Wednesday, we will be here answering your questions of a nostalgic nature about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The number to call is 1-800-603-6453. 1-800-603-6453. We have Donald from Virginia calling in. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Donald. Can you tell us about John DePalma?
Yes.
We all know about Ralph, but I don't know anything about John.
Okay, that's Ralph's brother. I don't know whether he was older or younger, but DePalma, I'm not sure actually how many were in the family. I think he had a couple of sisters, at least one, because His sister was the mother of Peter DePaulo, who was Ralph's nephew. John DePalma at the Speedway drove 1500, and that was in 1915. He drove a DeLarge, and apparently it was the car that René Thomas had driven to victory the year before. There were two of those cars, and the story is that they were taking them back to France, and when they were on the dock in New York, that a lady purchased the car, and it must have gone through several hands, because I think it was a fellow, I think it was James B. Wilson, I think was the entrant in 1915. Anyway, DePalma did, he actually spun the car and hit they used to have an inside wall, which did not come out until 33, I think, or 30, somewhere in there. Anyway, John DePalma did hit that, and had a wheel askew, but he did qualify and then ran in the race, but did not last very long in it. And that's the only time that he drove here. He had a few other starts, but what he did for a living, I do not know, but I think he was in the promotional business for a while. And then he passed away, I think it's December of 51, and I've seen a date, but I've never been able to confirm that that's so. Also, I think he had a brief involvement with the track at Sheepshead Bay, New York, which is down very close to Coney Island, and was there for just a few years. I do not believe that survived World War I. So I think that by 1920 or so, that was gone. But I think he did have a brief involvement with that. But the trivia is that Ralph DePalma was the first person to win the 500 with his brother in the lineup. Now, there's several people that have done that since, but they were the first. So I think that's probably about all I can do on John. I think his given name was actually Giovanni, I think, which is the Italian for John, I think. But he was Uncle Johnny while he was around here. Was there anybody else that you'd like for a follow-up? Because that didn't last very long.
How about Earl DeVore?
All right, sure, I'll do that one. Actually, I do have to take a break. But if you want to hang on, I will be happy to do Earl DeVore. But it is time to take care of some more business here. If you would like to, we do have another caller hanging on after Donald. But if you'd like to give us a call tonight, the number is 1-800-603-6453. 1-800-603-6453. We'll be back with more of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana right after this. We are back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and Donald from Virginia was asking for a profile on Earl DeVore, and I'm sure that you've asked that because he's the other driver that went down on the SS Vestris, which, and I don't mean to be laughing when I say that, that was the ship that went down in November of 1928 off the coast of Virginia. Norman Batten, we talked about last night, and Earl DeVore was he drove in three 500s. The first year he was at the track was 1915, before war. He was in one of the FRP cars and turned a time, a single lap time, that ended up, didn't start in the race. I think they withdrew because they certainly had less than the 30 car maximum at that time. They only had 24 cars met the requirements. But anyway, FRP was Finley Robertson Porter, who was the chief engineer for Mercer, and he left and decided to do his own thing. Anyway, Earl DeVore drove one of those cars in practice in 1915 and didn't make it. The next time he came back was 1925, 10 years later, when he drove a Miller, and that finished 13th with two relief drivers, Glenn Schultz and Laura Corum. And then 1926 with the Chroma Light Special, he was a non-starter. 1927, he drove a Miller Special and finished second with Zeke Meyer. Herbert Ernest Zeke Meyer was the relief driver. And then in 1928, he did drive the Chroma Light Special. And I don't think he was running at the end. He did. He was 18th was his finishing position, and he dropped out fairly late in the race. And then, as I mentioned, I believe it was last night, we were talking about Norman Batten. Norman Batten and Earl DeVore were very good friends, and they had made an arrangement to go down and race in Argentina in the winter of 28-29. They went with their wives and the two Millers, and at least I think they took the Millers. I'm not sure. They did take race cars, but I'm not sure now that it was the Indianapolis cars, because at least one of the cars survived and the ship went down, so maybe they took dirt track cars. So I never thought about that till right now. But anyway, there was a heavy storm, and the ship took on water, and then it eventually sunk. Earl DeVore left behind a son, Billy, who started a riding mechanics career in 1931, and then in 1937 became a driver and was he was the first second-generation driver to compete in the 500, and then Billy DeVore drove from 37 to 48, did not start in every year, and then, of course, we had 4 years because of the war. He was still out there practicing as late as 1954, but 48 was his last start. Anyway, Donald, we thank you very much indeed for the call. I'm going to move on because we have a couple more that we're going to try to get in before the end of the show. And next will be Jay from St. Paul. Good evening, Jay.
Good evening, Donald. There's a slow-moving high-pressure zone here in St. Paul. What's it look like there?
Overcast, but it's okay.
Okay.
It was a very pleasant day.
You were talking about radio announcers before. I wanted to know, how far back does a public address system go? When would they introduce drivers and riding mechanics and stuff like that? And did someone way back do a running commentary at the track?
They had announcers that they actually used megaphones in the early years, and apparently they had several fellows with strong voices up and down the straightaway, as I understand it, with megaphones, and probably Boy Scouts or certainly messengers that could well have been Boy Scouts would run up and down with pieces of information for the fellows to pass on to the spectators. At some point there was an electronic public address system, and I do not know when that first started, but I do know, I think I read that in 1936, Eddie Rickenbacker thought that the infield should be able to hear the public address system, and so additional speakers were put up in 36 to cover the infield, so obviously it goes back before that. As far as a running commentary, and then I'll sort of jump over to radio a little bit. The earliest radio apparently was 1922 at the Speedway, and they had three opportunities to hear it on radio, but they were all just like ham radio operators. I mean, none of them was a professional station. Then in 23, I don't think there was any. And then 1924, WFBM, I believe, certainly by 25, but I think 24. And then 25 or 26, big Chicago station, WGN. It was, thank you. Scott Johnson gave it. I just blanked on it. WGN with a, I think it was at Quinn Buckner, I think, maybe was the voice. But anyway, they started to do it, and Presto Light was the sponsor. So, and then in 1928, NBC sent in Graham McNamee, and that was a big deal at the time because he was the legendary broadcaster that for NBC that did major sports events, but also just major events. And so he came here in 28, and actually for several years, and NBC would do the beginning, the end, and then updates in between. Sometime not too long after that, maybe early 30s, and CBS came with Ted Husing, and then eventually the Mutual Radio Network. But anyway, that's sort of off the subject a little bit because you wanted to know about electronic public address, and I wish I knew the answer to that. I really don't have any idea when that started, but I would say probably maybe around the time when radio got going, so sometime maybe early to mid-20s would be my guess. Okay, Jay?
Okay, thank you.
All right, I mean, do you have a follow-up? Or?
I have another caller, fine, but you could do some S.F. Brock.
Oh, S.F. Brock?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. 1914... he drove a car called the Ray, and this is a bit of a mystery character because the early reports were that he was from Indianapolis, but in fact I think he was from Portland, Oregon, and he entered this car called the Ray, which I think was basically Mercer parts, if not a complete Mercer, but he brought it to the city early and found a garage somewhere near downtown and prepped it for the 1914 race, qualified, and was the first one out. And then the mystery about him, and I've had several people work on this, and maybe someday we'll get the answer. His name is listed in the 1919 program. They have like a memorial page with people who lost their lives during World War One. And one of them is S.F. Brock, and it says that there's something that he's lost in a submarine disaster off the coast of England in 1918. And I've done quite a bit of research, and several other people have as well, and we have not yet been able to identify what the submarine was. Maybe one day somebody will have the answer. Anyway, Jay, we thank you very much indeed for the call. We've got a few more minutes to go here. The number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453, and we will be back right after this. We have a few more minutes left on tonight's edition of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We're here each weeknight, so we'll be here through Friday. We do not do the weekends, but we'll be back Monday through Wednesday. And we'd love to hear from you. And if you are listening to a station, I know some of you are listening to us through your computers, but if you are listening to a station that is on Network Indiana, you might want to call the switchboard tomorrow and thank them for calling for carrying the show if you are enjoying it. We have Thomas from Anderson, and good evening. Thank you. What would you like to hear about?
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
I'm wondering about a driver that from South Bend area that...
Charlie Van Acker?
Pardon me?
Charlie Van Acker?
No.
Mike Saleh.
Wayne Woodward.
Oh, golly. yeah. I thought it was going to be Charlie Van Acker or Mike Saleh. Yeah, Wayne Woodward was an infamous character who's no longer living. He hung around the track and had a couple of apparent deals to drive, but he was never nominated to a car. He was a car owner briefly in 1979, never had a car in the race. And in fact, he had a car that qualified with Dick Ferguson driving. And actually fast enough to qualify, and then it turned out that he'd made a major technical change, which circumvented the regulations, and so the run was disallowed. And I'm not even sure, I don't know that he even had a chance to, no, he couldn't come back and make it because he completed the four laps and the run was disallowed, so he was thrown out. But he was rather an infamous character that would... And I have to be careful what I say here, but people who would sympathize with what he was trying to do, and then things would happen where they were sorry that they had done that. But he would disappear for a while, and then he would come back and then do the same thing to the same people. But anyway, he did drive... He drove midgets, he drove sprints, he used the Massoon names. I think he ran URC, United Racing Club, sprint cars occasionally, and then also midgets, both under his real name and an assumed name, which I believe was a cousin. And then he had a cousin named Mark Hughes, who was quite a successful sprint car owner, who bristled if you... raised the question that he was related to Wayne Woodward. So, anyway, he did pass away several years ago, and I'm trying to think of some anecdotes that I could tell on the air. I believe that he was the guest of the government a couple of times, and just one of those people that when you saw him coming, you thought, uh-oh, better be careful here. Did you have somebody else you'd like to hear about? I mean, I can tell you about Mike Saleh and Charlie Van Acker.
Wayne had an injunction to get the race stopped at one time, and there's some controversy over that also.
That was back to that 1979 incident. In fact, I remember him being on WABC, and he I don't remember that. I don't think he could afford to get the injunction, but I know that it was threatened, and he said that he was getting a lot of attention and that he had had an offer to go on The Tonight Show. And I thought, well, gee, if you've got an offer to go on The Tonight Show, I think I would take it. I think what he meant was that he was trying to get on The Tonight Show. Getting an offer means that they want you to come, in which case I believe you would go. So I think he was probably exaggerating that point. But anyway, yeah, that would be over the 1979 incident, and I think he thought that he was going to get a lot of people on his side, but he didn't.
I thank you for the information.
All right, well, thank you very much indeed. And he did. He was involved also for a brief time. With a, in fact, if you're still there, sir, maybe you could tell me whatever happened to John O'Hanlon, who had the liquor stores up there. O'Hanlon's Little Cheaper, with the name of the stores. Are you still there?
I am, but right. I have no information on him.
Oh, all right then. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, all right then. Okay, well, he was from South Bend and entered a car one year. In fact, with Larry McCoy as a driver. And anyway, Wayne Wood was involved with him for a little while. But anyway, we thank you very much indeed for the call. And that is about all the time that we have for tonight. We will be back tomorrow night from 7 until 8. We'd like to thank Scott Johnston for being the on-site producer, and Matt Taylor, who is the producer down at the studio on the Circle. He's the fellow who answers the phone and then gets your information and then make sure that the call comes out here so that we can answer it. If you just caught the tail end of this, I'd like to call us tomorrow. I'll just throw out the number one more time. It is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. We will be here tomorrow night. In the meantime, that's about all the time that we have for us, so we'll talk to you tomorrow. Good night, everybody.